Hi, it's Rabbi Jim Egolf. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast and listening to it. This week, it's August the 31st, 2007, Elul the 18th, 5767. We're getting really close to the high holidays. This week, we're going to share things that have happened in Jewish history, maybe have a joke, and think about what the difference is between nothing and nothing, and what the difference is between divesting and divesting. Please stay tuned. We hope sit back, relax, and enjoy. Yishru, Yishru shalom, shalom, tova. Shabbat Shalom. I was going through some websites earlier this week, and I found nothing. Literally. Well, in reality, the news report I found was about nothing. I'm not sure if one can actually find nothing. It seems kind of paradoxical, but that might just be apropos. The following is the beginning of an article put out by the University of Minnesota. Astronomers find gaping hole in the universe. University of Minnesota astronomers has found an enormous hole in the universe. Nearly a billion, kind of Carl Sagan-esque, don't you think? A billion light years across. Empty of both normal matter, such as stars, galaxies, and gas, as well as the mysterious unseen dark matter. While earlier studies have shown holes or voids in the large-scale structure of the universe, this new discovery dwarfs them all. Not only has no one ever found a void this big, but we never even expected to find one this size, said Lawrence Rudnick, the University of Minnesota astronomy professor. Rudnick, along with his grad student, Shay Brown, thank you, Shay, for all the work, and associate professor Lilia Williams, also of the University of Minnesota, reported their findings in a paper accepted for publication in the Astrophysical Journal. As a rabbi who has to deal in theology on a pretty regular basis, I have to wonder about this huge hole in the universe and what it actually proves. Many people want proof for their belief, and seem to go to great lengths to either get the proof or to dismiss the notion of a God altogether. Thinking about this idea of the huge hole in the universe got me humming a song that then manifested itself into words. You probably know this song. I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. I got no car, got no mule, I got no misery. Folks with plenty of plenty, they've got a lock on the door. Afraid someone's going to rob 'em while they're out a-making more. What for? Ki tavo, when you enter into the land of Israel. Now, those who entered to actually give something had to acknowledge that at some point they were like the song above. They have nothing. Each Israelite had to acknowledge that their presence in the land was based on what scientists would have considered a whole lot of nothing. It was based on a promise from God that the land that God led Avram to would be an inheritance for his descendants. I'm not sure if people think Avram had plenty of nothing. That would be, there is a God and thus much to this promise, or maybe a little bit of nothing. Avram just had a bad dream, or maybe just an episode. However, if you hold to the story of the Torah, he had plenty of something. Then again, what really is the difference between plenty of nothing and only a little bit of nothing? Because, at the end of the day, plenty or a little bit of nothing is, well, nothing. But I digress. Now, I often feel a little cheated when relating to the nothing we are hearing from our scientists. You see, in science, if you prove that something exists, then you're doing good science. These astronomers found plenty of nothing. And it makes the news? If theologians claim that God is non-corporeal, that would be nothing like the matter that we know in this existence. Many of us use this as an excuse to doubt the existence of God. If astronomers find nothing, they're not considered to be bad astronomers. They have made a discovery. If theologians find nothing and claim that God does not have an existence like ours, then people doubt God's existence. Speaking of plenty of nothing, and sometimes how sermons collide together, we need to move beyond the search for nothing and understand that there is nothing that we can do about it. Kind of literal there. Looking for the nothings that we can do something about, we can look to the impending report that is being called the Petraeus Report. First, speaking of something and nothing, it has been reported that our general, that would be the one funded by our taxes, is not actually writing the report. He's giving it to someone else. I wonder who. And this person is insisting on writing it for him. I guess the general's busy off killing bad guys. Unfortunately, this masks the real issue that is occurring. I am speaking of the untold billions that are missing from the war effort. I went looking and found a very official document entitled Congressional Research Service. The cost of Iraq, Afghanistan, and other global war on terror operations since 9/11. In this report, the cost of all the war operations is reported on page 9, table 3, you can find it in the show notes, to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $610.5 billion. Back to those billions again. We've also tragically lost over 3,700 American troops. And who is doing well in this fiasco? Who is making something out of nothing and making a profit amidst billions of missing dollars and dead American soldiers? Representative Henry Waxman, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, asked, who in their right mind would send 360 tons of cash into a war zone? But that's exactly what our government did. Of the $610.5 billion, Custer Battles, got 12 billion, or just 7 tons of that cash. They did manage to lose or misplace, maybe somewhat conveniently, 5.2 tons of it, or $8.8 billion, according to an August 23, 2007 article appearing in Rolling Stones magazine. Beyond this, Halliburton has managed to procure several no-bid contracts, whose profit markup is commonly 15%. So I think that means that if we're spending 15 tons of that cash, we have to include an extra ton for Halliburton's profits every time. At least that's my understanding of it. My math could be a little off there. Regarding those missing weapons we recently heard about, according to the Washington Post, 190,000 AK-47s are gone. Not 190, 190,000. According to a very scary-looking website, www.ak-47.net, the average cost of one of those deadly weapons is somewhere between $300 and $800. Now, let's split the difference and call it $550 a gun. That would be $104.5 million. Or just 700 pounds of those dollar bills that Representative Waxman is currently looking for. One problem is that those weapons are often found in the hands of those who are looking to kill our soldiers. I share all of this with you because I think that there are things we can do in our country that will either help end this war, or at least help us to conduct it with a degree of accountability most of us would want, even in a mediocre accountant. Many of us hear about divesting from various countries, and we know that Israel was the target of this in recent years. It does have an effect to divest from state sponsors of terror. I also think that we need to begin to consider divesting from those companies that are a shame and mockery to our young soldiers who are putting their lives on the line for their country every day in a foreign land. If you want to do something, research these and other companies who do business in Iraq. Find out if they have been good stewards of the tax dollars you and I pay to conduct business. If they do so in a respectable fashion, don't worry about it. But if they don't, then divest from those whose record you just can't live with. We have the ability to elect our political leaders. However, we have a great weapon when it comes to telling those companies that do business with our tax dollars what to do. We can sell their stock. We can personally divest from these stocks and those financial instruments that seek gain by owning their shares. Whether it is terrorism or war profiteering, neither should be rewarded because both work to defeat our country. They just happen to inflict damage in different ways. We are told when we enter into the land of Israel that we have a choice between being a blessing or a curse. Our task is to find the way to be a blessing in our country, Israel, and to be a blessing in the way that we act in the wider world. To be a blessing is also being responsible with what we have and to whom we give it. When our country gave Stinger missiles to Afghan rebels, we were told it was good. However, when two of these Stinger missiles narrowly missed a civilian El Al 757 departing from Mombasa Airport in Kenya in 2002, we have to wonder about the good and blessing of missing weapons. We must demand from our world and our corporations a higher ethical standard than the bottom line. And if we cannot get that higher standard by requesting it, we should force it and do what we can to impact their profits. We are supposed to be and bring blessings, even as we read in the Torah, when it means giving something, including even a basket of fruit, to the source of that blessing. Shabbat Shalom. And now for a joke this week. This comes from Oi, the Ultimate Book of Jewish Jokes, by David Minkoff. Maurice, a young Jew, comes to New York and applies for a job as a caretaker at the Brooklyn Synagogue. The synagogue committee are just about to offer him the job when they discover that he is illiterate. They decide, for many reasons, that it would be inappropriate to have an illiterate caretaker. So Maurice leaves and decides to forge a career in another business. He chooses to sell plastic goods door to door. He does well and is soon able to buy a car, and later to open a store, and then a second. Finally, he is ready to open 5 more stores, and so applies to the bank for a loan. But when the bank manager asks him to sign the contract, it is obvious that he cannot write. Shocked to discover that this successful young man has little education, the bank manager says, "Just think what you could have been if you had learned to read and write." "Yes," says Maurice, "I would be the caretaker at the Brooklyn Synagogue." We're trying out a new feature on the podcast, and it's This Week in Jewish History. This Week in Jewish History in Kiev, 2,000 notices were posted in 1941, ordering Jews to appear the next day with documents, warm clothes, and valuables. Its results was the Baba Yar massacres. In 1967, Kfar Etzion was reestablished after the kibbutz was destroyed during the War of Independence in Israel, and its inhabitants massacred in 1948. In 1938, Hitler had convinced Chamberlain that he actually wanted to protect German rights and that he had no further demands on the rest of Europe. We found out that that was not necessarily the case. And in 1943, on Friday morning, Rabbi Mechori of Copenhagen canceled services for the new year, and during the next few weeks, almost 7,000 Danish Jews were saved from deportation to concentration camps. That's This Week in Jewish History. The music you hear on this podcast is from Magnatunes.com and the groups Yaaleh and Panacea. Please go out there and check out their website. They have some wonderful tunes, and if you can download and purchase a copy for yourself from Magnatunes.com. Well, that does it for this week's show. Thank you for joining me. I hope that you'll pod in or tune in next week, and we'll send you out to Zemer Atik.